Thank you, Brother Chairman, and my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and my dear young people. Well, we come this morning, as our Chairman has said, to the end of the story, and we've taken, of course, the title for this morning's comments from that reading in Ezekiel 37, I will make them one nation in the land. We might actually begin with Ezekiel 37 this morning, and we notice that in Ezekiel 37 that this story was dramatised by the prophet commencing from the 15th verse. We're told in Ezekiel 37 in verse 15, it says, "And the word of Yahweh came again unto me, saying, Moreover, thou son of man, take thee one stick, and write upon it, For Judah, and for the companion, for the children of Israel, his companions. And then take another stick, and write upon it, For Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for all the house of Israel, his companions." So here we have the two houses again of the land. We have one stick for Judah, and one stick for Ephraim, the house of Judah, and the house of Israel. And verse 17 says, "And join them one to another into one stick, and they shall become one in thine hand. And when the children of thy people shall speak unto thee, saying, Wilt thou not show us what thou meanest by these? Say unto them, Thus saith the Lord Yahweh, Behold, I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribe of Israel his fellows, and I will put them with him even with the stick of Judah, and will make them one stick, and they shall be one in mine hand." Now, of course, the Mormons have got this a little bit wrong, haven't they? Because what the Mormons teach is that the two sticks, in fact, refer to the sticks upon which scrolls are written. And so they suggest that the two sticks stand for two scrolls. And one scroll is the Bible. And the other scroll, of course, surprise, surprise, is the Book of Mormon. And therefore, that although these two scrolls have been written at different places and at different times, that they are really one and the same. The two sticks are united together as the revelation of God's purpose. Well, it's not too hard to be able to dispense with Mormon teaching on the meaning of the sticks, because first of all, they were sticks, not scrolls. The second thing is that they had names written on them, and the names were the house of Judah, or for Judah, and for his companions, and for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim. And then see what the prophet says in verse 20, because the prophet gives his own definition of what this little episode meant. Verse 20, "And the sticks whereon thou writest shall be in thine hands before their eyes, and say unto them." So when he was to utter this prophecy which follows, which is the prophecy that we're going to look at this morning, God willing, he was to hold the two sticks together in his hand. And holding those aloft to the nation, he was then to say, verse 21, "And say unto them, Thus saith the Lord Yahweh, Behold, I will take the children of Israel from among the heathen whither they be gone, and will gather them on every side and bring them into their own land, and I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel, and one king shall be king to them all, and they shall be no more two nations." And that's what the sticks meant. It represent the bringing together of the house of Israel and the house of Judah at the time of the end, this glorious final time when the two houses of Israel are reunited together under the messiahship of the Lord Jesus Christ. And what a dramatic way to show that final state of the nation, as Ezekiel the prophet was to take these two sticks and to hold them in his hand together, clutched together, as he then made the prophecy of Ezekiel 37 and verses 21 to the end of the chapter, which forms the basis of our comments this morning. So verse 21 says, "And say unto them, Thus saith the Lord Yahweh, Behold, I will take the children of Israel from among the heathen whither they be gone, and will gather them on every side and bring them into their own land." Well, that's really where we've got to so far in the story, in fact, isn't it? We've got now to this very stage where they've come through the wilderness of the peoples, they've assembled in this area of the intermediate wilderness, and they have now come together, whichever side they've come from, they've now joined together at the moment of crossing over the Jordan to enter into those other parts of the land that lie beyond Jordan. So verse 21 has now been fulfilled. "I will take the children of Israel from among the heathen whither they be gone, and will gather them in on every side and bring them into their own land." Now verse 22 says, "I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel. But there's really two or three prophecies that we need to look at that really come in between verse 21 and verse 22 of Ezekiel 37 that help us now to fill out the story of what this chapter is all about. And the first of those is the prophecy of Hosea and chapter 2. So in Hosea chapter 2 now, we have some detail that helps us to add to the story of where Ezekiel has brought us to. Ezekiel 37 verse 21, I'll bring them all into the land, and then verse 22 says I'll make them one nation, and that really is the subject of our comments this morning. Now Hosea chapter 2 says, Hosea chapter 2 and verse 14. It says there, therefore behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably unto her, and I will give her her vineyards from thence and the valley of Achor for a door of hope, and she shall sing there as in the days of her youth and as in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt. And it shall be at that day, saith Yahweh, that thou shalt call me Ishai. Thou shalt no more call me Baali. For I will take away the names of Balaam out of her mouth, and they shall no more be remembered by their name. So the prophet says in verse 14, therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably to her. So here in the wilderness now, the house of Israel has been gathered that God might speak comfortably to them as the stages of reconciliation to him are completed. You see what the margin says? Speak comfortably to her. Speak to her heart is perhaps the force of the literal Hebrew. I will speak to her heart. And you notice the cross-reference. We might come back and have a look at that. There's a cross-reference there. Remember, reference work. Our little story last night. Let's have a look at Isaiah chapter 40, because now we're right back to where we started from in our address concerning Elijah and the fulfillment of Isaiah chapter 40 and Malachi chapter 3, the cries of the messengers. So you see really what's happening here, verse 1 of Isaiah 40. Comfort ye my people, saith your God. Speak ye to the heart, and there's that word, speak ye to the heart of Jerusalem, and cry unto her that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned, for she has received of Yahweh's hand double for all her sins. The voice of him that crieth in the wilderness, prepare ye the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. You'll notice that I've read verse 3 with a slightly different emphasis when I've used it. I've suggested that it should be read, the voice of him that crieth, comma, in the wilderness prepare ye the way of Yahweh, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. And that's to retain the force of the Hebrew parallelism there. You'll see that when you read it in that way. In the wilderness prepare ye the way of the Lord, in the desert make straight a highway for our God, the voice of him that crieth. And so what we're being told here, since Hosea 2 is talking about the speaking to the heart of the house of Israel as they are allured into the wilderness, what we're being told is that this final cry of the voice preparing the way in the wilderness of Isaiah 40 must in fact be Elijah, not John the Baptist. That although John came in the spirit and power of Elijah, that the final crying of this voice, the final bringing into the wilderness to speak to the heart, is in fact to the house of Israel. And it's for that very reason that they have been allured into the wilderness, where they might now hear the power of that voice crying unto them, but this time the voice cries out of the mouth of Elijah and the refined third of Judah, those that escape of them, that are sent unto the nations together with Elijah, and those saints who are privileged to be with Elijah on that occasion. So coming back to Hosea chapter 2, therefore, we're saying that here then is the final work of Isaiah 40. It was fulfilled in the time and in the life of John the Baptist, but it is yet repeated under Elijah. And what a marvellous thing to think that Elijah's work then finally will be to speak to the hearts of people. That was always Elijah's problem, wasn't it? Elijah was too blunt, too strong, too confrontational. He never ever did really understand his own spirit. And God eventually plucked him out of the house of Israel and said, your work will be accomplished later on. And when Elijah does come forth to complete this work of restoration, he will have learnt the secret of his own power, and he will speak to the heart of the house of Israel, and by that means will truly change them, that they might be inclined towards Yahweh Elohim of Israel again. Will be a great and mighty thing for Elijah. And you can imagine also, by the way, I've often thought this, how tremendously encouraging it therefore would have been for Elijah to discuss the matter of the Exodus with the Lord on the Mount of Transfiguration. Imagine being able to discuss with Moses and with the Lord the spirit of how the Exodus really should be accomplished. Elijah was on the mountain with them, of course, says the record. I suppose that's controversial, isn't it? Ask me afterwards, if you like, why I think they were really there, and I'll tell you why I think Elijah and Moses were really on the mountain, but we won't go into that now because that is a digression. Verse 15 says, and I will give her vineyards from thence, and the valley of Achor for a door of hope. So you see what it says, verse 15? I will give her vineyards from thence. Now where is the from thence? And the answer is from the wilderness. So what Hosea chapter 2 and verse 15 is saying is that the house of Israel must pass through the wilderness before they are entitled to receive their possession in the land of promise itself. They will receive their vineyards, and of course that's got Solomonic overtones, hasn't it? Every man will sit under his own fig tree and under his own vine. They will receive their vineyards, the blessings of the kingdom age, from thence. They must travel through the wilderness first. That's God's prerequisite before they can receive his blessings. And of course the reason for that is because it's in the wilderness that their heart is purged, their mind is changed towards the Father, they enter into covenant relationship with him, they make their vows of faithfulness to serve him, they acknowledge their sin and their confusion. Remember the words of Jeremiah 3? We acknowledge our sin. And Elijah causes the nation to pledge themselves again that they might be faithful to their God. And only having gone through, therefore, those wilderness experiences are they then allowed to receive the blessings of the kingdom and the vineyards which they are entitled to be settled in the land itself. And where will they come through? It says, I will give them the valley of Achor for a door of hope, says the record there in the 15th verse. Now the valley of Achor, of course, is just a little to the north of the Dead Sea. It in fact represents the place where the children of Israel crossed over in previous times. So in the day of the crossing under Joshua, the place associated with the crossing, or one of the places associated with the crossing, was in fact the Valley of Achor. And so there's going to be a memorialization of what it was like when they came out under the hand of Moses. It says that in verse 15, doesn't it? As in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt. They are reliving the experiences of the previous exodus of Israel, and they come now to the identical spot, ready now to cross over the Jordan. They're in the land already, don't forget, because they're in the land promised to Abraham, but they are now about to cross over the Jordan and to enter into the land that they might go up to Zion, and they're going to pass through the Valley of Achor. One wonders, by the way, how 11 million people are going to pass through the Valley of Achor, because it's actually, has anyone been to the Valley of Achor? Anyone here been to the Valley of Achor? It's actually a very narrow, tight defile that winds its way up into the Judean mountains. One comes across the Jordan River to the flat lands below, and then one climbs up this quite steep defile. The bus gets right down to first gear in order to make it, and up the steep defile you go to ascend up onto the Judean plateau above, from which point you can then proceed across the Judean plateau either north or south, and it's one of the main routes up onto the Judean plateau. But we're told, you don't need to turn this up, but you might like to take a note of it, that one of the geographical changes that will take place in the land at the time will be the widening of the valley of Achor, because Isaiah chapter 65 and verse 10 says that in the future Sharon shall be a fold for flocks and the valley of Achor a place for the herds to lie down in, for my people that have sought me. So Isaiah 65 and verse 10 specifically prophesies the widening of the valley of Achor in the age to come. It'll be a place wide enough and expansive enough for herds to lie down in the age to come. And up through that particular valley, says Hosea chapter 2, the people will now enter across the Jordan and up onto the Judean plateau. It will become to them a door of hope. Now obviously the phrase door of hope really means the place that they enter in through, doesn't it? That's the force of the idea of a door. It's the place that they, it's the point of entrance as far as the house of Israel here is concerned. It says, and she shall sing there as in the days of old. Actually, the word sing there conveys more than just the idea of singing. It actually has the idea of responding. She shall respond there as in the days of old. And what it's talking about, therefore, is that the spirit of the house of Israel is now made truly responsive to the teaching and the doctrine of the new covenant, and the house of Israel now desires to be joined to the God of Israel and to the King of Israel and to their brethren, the house of Judah. She shall respond there as in the days of her youth. Actually, that's interesting, because if you come back to the valley of Achor in the time of Joshua himself, we just see something interesting at the end of that story. It's Joshua chapter 7. So here's the moment of time when the valley of Achor is mentioned in the historical record now of the exodus of the house of the children of Israel under the charge of Moses and Joshua. Remember now, we're in Joshua chapter 7. We've come across the Jordan and Moses is dead. He of course has not entered in. The children of Israel are now under Joshua. You'll remember the story of Achan, who coveted the goodly Babylonish garment and the 200 shekels of silver and a wedge of gold of 50 shekels weight. We're told in Joshua 7 and verse 25, perhaps verse 24, and Joshua and all Israel with him took Achan the son of Zerah and the silver and the garment and the wedge of gold and his sons and daughters, his oxen, his asses, his sheep, his tent, and all that he had, and they brought them unto the valley of Achor. And Joshua said, why hast thou troubled us? Yahweh shall trouble thee this day. And of course that's what Achor means. It means trouble. And all Israel stoned him with stones and burned them with fire after they had stoned them with stones. And then notice this. And they raised over him a great heap of stones unto this day. So Yahweh turned from the fierceness of his anger, wherefore the name of that place was called the Valley of Achor unto this day. And so we believe that in the historical record of things, the Valley of Achor did not just memorialize the troubling of the children of Israel by Achan, but it represented the moment where the fierceness of Yahweh's anger was turned away and his wrath was appeased. And that, of course, is the spirit of this time also with the house of Israel, isn't it? That God is now pleased to bless his people. His wrath has been appeased. His anger has been turned away from them. They are now truly ready to enter through the door of hope into the land of promise itself. We're not told in verse 15, whether Elijah will take them across and through the valley of Achor. Any thoughts on that? How far do you think Elijah goes in this story? Elijah's brought them to this point now. Yes, I think so, and I think that Paul suggests this in Hebrews chapter 3. If you come and have a look at Hebrews 3, I think that there's, it's not that Paul is specifically talking about this, but the inference we draw would be, I think, sound in that regard. We're told in Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 16, it says, "For some, when they had heard, did provoke, howbeit not all that came out of Egypt by Moses." Now the Revised Standard Version renders Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 16 in quite a different way, and I believe that it is in harmony with the contextual flow of the passage, and this is what the Revised Standard Version says. You'll need to listen to this carefully because it does change it. "Who were they that heard and yet were rebellious? Was it not all those who left Egypt under the leadership of Moses?" I'll read that again. "Who were they that heard and yet were rebellious? Was it not all those who left Egypt under the leadership of Moses?" And the point, now you see, that's the same point as verse 17. "And with whom was he grieved 40 years? Was it not with them that had sinned, whose carcasses fell in the wilderness?" And it's the same point in verse 18 as well. "And to whom swear he that they should not enter into his wrath? Was it not them that believed not?" So you see, in Hebrews chapter 3, you've got, in fact, a very similar statement being made three times in a row. Who was it that heard, verse 16, and yet was rebellious? Was it not those that came out of Egypt with Moses? Verse 17. With whom was he grieved? Was it not them that sinned? Verse 18. And to whom swear he that they should not enter in? Was it not them that believed not? Now you see, the force of the argument of the apostle on this occasion, well, you know what he's trying to prove, of course, in Hebrews 3. What's the overall thing contextually that Paul's endeavouring to argue in Hebrews 3? He's endeavouring to argue the superiority of Christ over Moses. Remember, this is the whole theme of the book of Hebrews. Christ's superiority over the angels, over Moses, over Aaron, over Joshua, over the law, over the sacrifices, over the tabernacle. This is the superiority of Christ above everything associated with the law. Here he's arguing in Hebrews 3 the superiority of the Lord over Moses. Now the argument that the apostle's making here is that a whole generation perished under Moses. Who was it that heard, verse 16, and yet were rebellious? Was it not all those who came under the leadership of Moses? And what Paul is saying is that Moses never could bring them into the promised land. He never did. Moses, if you think about it, presided really over the generation who did not enter in. Moses never ever did take them into the land. And the force of the apostle's argument is, and this flows straight into Hebrews chapter 4, is Moses cannot bring you into the Sabbath rest. Therefore, says the apostle, we have to look to a Joshua to do that for us. That's his argument in Hebrews. Moses was never able to take them into the land. Therefore, we must look to the Joshua who can take us into the promised rest, because that's the force of the historical record. Moses presided over the generation that did not enter in. It was Joshua that took the new generation in. Now, of course, under the type, as you quite correctly say, Gary, under the type, Elijah is Moses. And Jesus is Joshua. So, therefore, we would suggest that it would be appropriate, under the principles of that type, that likewise Elijah will stop at that particular moment of time, having brought them to the valley of Achor for the door of hope. It's been Elijah's work to bring them into the wilderness, to speak to their heart, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, to make ready a people prepared. But now they've come to that particular moment of the entering in of the valley of Achor. Now is the time for the Joshua to take over after the manner of their coming out of Egypt in the days of old. And so I think that is appropriate. That's certainly what Brother Thomas suggests as well in Mystery of the Covenant, and I think there is some force to that idea. And so I believe that the Lord, in fact, does not stay in Zion. I think the Lord actually comes to meet them there at the valley, and that when the house of Israel arrive at that moment, as they ascend up into the valley of Achor, that there is the Lord waiting to meet them at that point. You can imagine what an emotional moment this is, as the house of Israel, now the 10 tribes, are now confronted by the one whom the nation rejected 2,000 years before. Judah have already been through this national humiliation, haven't they? They've already had to meet their Messiah, and in dramatic circumstances. They've already had their moment of national lamentation. Now it's the turn of the house of Israel to meet the Messiah whom they've rejected, and he's there waiting for them at the entering in of the Valley of Achor, ready to take over as the anti-typical Joshua. And there alongside with the Lord are representatives of the saints and also of their brethren of the house of Judah, all waiting for the house of Israel to come up at that particular point of time. And I think actually that that's when Zechariah chapter 9 is fulfilled. You might come and have a look at that, because again, we're saying, you know, a lot of these places, a lot of these references that we use in the prophets, there must of course contextually be a particular moment in time when these prophecies are properly fulfilled. Many of them may have more than one fulfilment, many of them have an incipient fulfilment, but they must also have, if you like, the real fulfilment of which the prophet spoke concerning. And Zechariah 9, I think, is, well, this is the moment for the ultimate fulfilment of Zechariah 9, verse 9. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, thy king cometh unto thee. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding upon an ass, and upon a colt the foal of an ass. And I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim, and the horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off, and he shall speak peace unto the heathen, and his dominion shall be from sea to sea, and from the river even to the ends of the earth. And as for thee also, by the blood of thy covenant I have sent forth thy prisoners out of the pit wherein is no water. Zechariah chapter 9 is that moment of time when the children of Israel conduct their own king into Jerusalem, into Zion. When is the moment, really, when the king of Israel is conducted by his own people into the capital city from whence he will reign? I think this is the moment. The house of Judah and the house of Israel are now both here, and the combined tribes now conduct their king to the place of his capital, and as they do so they shout and say, Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion, thy king cometh unto thee. And there are all the tribes now with their king. They have been united unto him, and they accompany him to Zion, the city and the capital of David. Well, Brother Thomas summarizes all of this in a lovely way in Mystery of the Covenant in the following words. He says, the recovery of the Valley of Achor becomes to them the earnest of inheriting the whole land, the object of their hope. Hence it is styled a door of hope, as well as on account of its being the place through which they enter the land. It is unnecessary for us now to trace their progress further. After arriving at the door, now obviously in this context the door must be the Valley of Achor, mustn't it? After arriving at the door, under Elijah's administration, we may be sure they will not be denied admission to the presence of Judah's king. You see how carefully Brother Thomas phrases his thoughts there. You see, he's actually suggesting the very thing that we've suggested. After arriving at the door under Elijah's administration, we may be sure they will not be denied admission by Judah's king. So who's actually waiting at the door to open to them? Not Elijah, but Judah's king. It will be a day of happy reunion for all the tribes. For they will sing in the Valley of Achor as in the days of their nation's youth. Judah and Ephraim will be reconciled. For the jealousy of Ephraim shall cease, and the enmity of Judah shall be no more. Ephraim shall not envy Judah, and Judah shall not be at enmity with Ephraim. The land bequeathed to Abraham, to their king, to his nobles, and to themselves, in the covenant confirmed of Yahweh, and purged by the blood of his son, will be fully possessed by their distribution over its valleys and plains and mountains, and into the land the house of Israel comes, that they might be settled after their former estates. And they're going to be reconciled, you see, as Isaiah 11 says. We might just go and have a look at that one, because it's an interesting reference. Isaiah chapter 11 is a time, therefore, which predicts this. Remember the theme of Ezekiel 37, I will make them one nation in the land. Remember, they've come to that point now. We're now looking at what circumstances now bring all the tribes together that they might be reconciled in the land. Well, Isaiah chapter 11 puts it this way, and in verse 12. "And he shall set up an ensign for the nations, and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel," so that's the house of Israel, isn't it, "and gather together the dispersed of Judah." Now, who's the dispersed of Judah? The answer is, we believe, those who at the time of the Battle of Armageddon are deported, Joel 3 verses 4 to 7, into captivity, Zechariah 14 verse 2. So there are those who are the dispersed of Judah at this time, who've been sent out of the land, as Joel 3 verses 4 to 7 tell us, and Zechariah 14 verse 2. "The envy," verse 13, "the envy also of Ephraim shall depart, and the adversaries of Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim shall not envy Judah, and Judah shall not vex Ephraim." And the word envy here means, well, it sounds really, I mean, it really means envy, but it's a very strong word, it's a very powerful verb. It expresses a very strong emotion whereby some quality or possession of the object is greatly desired by the subject. Now, I know that that's really just another definition for envy, but what do you think it's been, particularly, that Ephraim envies of Judah? What do you think the main thing has been down through the history of the nation that's caused Ephraim to envy Judah? Ephraim shall not envy Judah. Sorry? They were dispersed, yes. Possession of Jerusalem, yes. Yeah, all of that, all, I agree with all of those things. Phew. So it is true, isn't it, that there are several things that Ephraim could have envied. The fact that they were dispersed before the house of Judah, the fact that the house of Judah has had control of Jerusalem, and someone said the matter of kingship. Shiloh belongs to the tribe of Judah, and Ephraim, in fact, you can actually trace this in the record. There are many times in the history of the nation where Ephraim envied the matter of rulership. They coveted after that. That was a source of discontent between Ephraim and Judah. And what this is now saying is that that final rift is now going to be taken away, and the two houses of Israel are going to be wonderfully restored, because now there is absolutely no doubt as to who's ruling. Shiloh has come, and they will all accept him. The argument has gone forever about the matter of who shall be king, and Jerusalem will be, of course, the capital of all the tribes anyway. You know, brothers and sisters, that rift still exists today. The house of Judah are those in the land today. Those in dispersion are the house of Israel. Do you know that there are arguments that happen even today whereby the Jews in America and the Jews in other places are sometimes very scathing of what's going on in the land? And the dispersed of Jewry throughout the land are often very critical of decisions made by those Jews in the land. It's the ancient envy between the house of Israel and the house of Judah as to what should be done in certain things. And you'll find often that there are criticisms by prominent Jewish leaders in communities around the world saying we totally disagree with what's been done about this or that, or how they've handled the Palestinians or whatever. And there's even today that sense of rift between the two houses. That's all going to be resolved. And you know what the reconciliation is really that Isaiah has in mind here? This is the reconciling of a rift that goes all the way back to the time of Rehoboam and Jeroboam, when the kingdom was first divided after the reign of Solomon. That's the rift that's going to be healed here, isn't it? And the envy between the two houses is finally going to be dissolved. That's been there all that time. They've never, ever been united since. And only now, at this moment, when the house of Israel come into the valley of Achor and joined with their brethren of the house of Judah, only now does that envy and that jealousy finally pass away. And that's really what... Well, let's go back to Ezekiel 37, because that's what Ezekiel 37 says. That's the spirit of this study, actually, isn't it? The day when the two houses are finally brought back together again, and all traces of enmity and hostility disappear. That's, well, we can now safely come back, in fact, to Ezekiel, chapter 37 and verse 22. Now that we've looked at Hosea and the moment that they arrive, and we've looked at Zechariah 9 as they conduct the tribes together, and we've looked at Isaiah 11 as the final envy between the two houses is removed, now verse 22 of Ezekiel 37 says, "And I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel, and one king shall be king to them all." That's the king they've just conducted to Zion together. "And they shall be no more two nations, neither shall they be divided into two kingdoms any more." That rift has now finally and wonderfully been healed. Verse 23 says, "Neither shall they defile themselves any more with their idols, nor with their detestable things, nor with any of their transgressions, but I will save them out of all their dwelling places wherein they have sinned, and will cleanse them. So shall they be my people, and I will be their God." And so there's going to come this moment of time when everything that is detestable and hateful in the two houses will be totally purged away from the presence of the Father. The spirit of pride, the spirit of envy, the spirit of idolatry, the spirit of fierce independence, the spirit of godlessness, all of those things exist in those two houses today, and they're all going to be purged at this particular time. You see the reference at the end of the verse. This is a very, very famous little phrase. "So shall they be my people, and I will be their God." Do you know that that's actually a golden thread that runs through the Bible record? Do you know the first time that ever occurred? It's in the story of the first Exodus, Exodus chapter 6. Exodus chapter 6 and verse 6. "Wherefore say unto the children of Israel, I am Yahweh, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will rid you out of their bondage, and I will redeem you with a stretched out arm and with a great judgment, and I will take you to me for a people, and I will be to you a God." So you see that phrase, "They shall be my people, and I will be their God." Now there is the beginning of a phrase or an idea that then runs through the whole of the Bible record. And what do you think that means, by the way? What does that really mean, boiled down to its fundamental? "I will be their God, and they shall be my people." What do you think that actually means? Yes, it does mean that. Anything else? Just, you know, I think there's something about Bible study. Always take the obvious meaning. Yes. I believe that what it's saying is, and this is what makes Israel unique, this phrase is what makes Israel unique. They, of all peoples, have a covenant relationship with God. They have a unique and special fellowship with God. "I will be their God, and they will be my people." He doesn't say that of any other nation, does he? No other nation are my people. And no other nation in this particular sense can say this is our God. So what this is saying is that Israel enjoys a unique and special relationship with God that no other nation does. Now that was the promise of Exodus 6. "They shall be my God and I will be their people." There is a unique relationship of fellowship. There is a special bond of fellowship that Israel of all the nations has with God. That reminds us of a phrase, doesn't it? "You only of all nations of the earth have I known," is a Bible passage, isn't it? Just have a look at one or two places where that turns up. If you come through to the 2nd of Samuel chapter 7, the 2nd of Samuel 7, now that should be a Bible echo. What's the 2nd of Samuel 7? That's the promises of promises to David, covenant to David. Look what David says in the 2nd of Samuel chapter 7. He says in verse 24, perhaps verse 23 again for connection, 2 Samuel 7, 23, And what one nation in the earth is like thy people, even like Israel, whom God went to redeem for a people to himself, and to make him a name, and to do for you great things and terrible for thy land before thy people, which thou redeemest to thee from Egypt, and for the nations and their gods. For thou hast confirmed to thyself thy people Israel to be a people unto thee forever, and thou, Yahweh, art become their God. They shall be my people, and I will be their God. This is a golden thread, you see. Jeremiah chapter 31. Now, this is an interesting one. What's Jeremiah 31 all about? Before you get there, can someone tell me? Jeremiah 31. It's a restoration prophecy indeed. And it's actually a chapter about the making of the new covenant. Now, have a look at Jeremiah 31 and verse 31. So again, contextual correctness. Well, here we go. Jeremiah 31, verse 31. Behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they break, although I was an husband unto them. But this shall be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, saith Yahweh, I will put my law in their inward parts. Hymn 250, choir members, and write it in their hearts, and will be their God, and they shall be my people. There it is. There's the promise, you see, of covenant relationship with God. That's the terms of the new covenant. This is the special promise, you see, to Israel. Let's come and have a look at a couple more, just out of interest. Zechariah 13, oh, this is a beauty. We actually didn't have time to look at this the other day. Zechariah chapter 13 and verse 9. Now this is the house of Judah, not the house of Israel. Zechariah 13 verse 9. And I will bring the third part through the fire, and will refine them as silver is refined, and will try them as gold is tried. And they shall call on my name, and I will hear them. And I will say, it is my people. And they shall say, Yahweh is my God. You know, that's a dramatic moment in the story of the house of Judah. Remember that they're brought to that moment of despair where they feel that all hope is lost. And at that moment of crisis, verse 9 says, and they shall call on my name. And you know what God says? God says, that's my people. I can hear them. I've waited 2,000 years to hear them make that cry. And I will be their God. And they shall be my people. That's Zechariah 13 verse 9. Do you know that this reference, you know the last time it ever occurs in the Bible? Revelation chapter 21. Whew. So this is a golden thread that really runs through the whole of the Bible record. I've only given you just a handful. You can trace it through yourself in much more detail. Now look at this one, Revelation 21. So it's the special promise to Israel, isn't it, of covenant fellowship with God. Revelation 21 and verse 2. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he shall dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. Do you know that Revelation 21, verses 1 to 8, is the longest passage in the Bible we have about life after the kingdom age? The first 8 verses of Revelation 21 are about the period after the kingdom age, the period of time known as the Ad. And at that time, every single member, every single person upon the face of the globe has now received immortality. All those that are unfaithful have been cast away and have entered into the second death. The whole world now is glorified and immortalized. And because of that, they are now all Israel. The whole world is now full of Israelites. And so they shall be his people, and God will be their God. The whole world has now been absorbed into the nation of Israel. This is right at the end of the kingdom age, at the beginning of the period beyond. Do you know where this phrase actually comes from? I'll just show you where it comes from, and then we must move on. Genesis chapter 17. This is actually where the phrase comes from. Although it's found in Exodus 6 for the first time in its fullest sense, the beginning of the phrase is really drawn from Genesis chapter 17. So there's a golden thread for you. Here is a phrase that begins in the book of Genesis and ends up in the book of Revelation. What a marvellous way of showing that the Bible's got to be read as one whole. You know, all these people that want to dispense with the Old Testament and have a church practice based on New Testament ideas, well, they certainly wouldn't understand that phrase in Revelation, because you can trace that all the way back to the very first book of the Bible, to Genesis. Now here it is, Genesis 17. This is the promises to Abraham. This is the Abrahamic covenant. Now the Abrahamic covenant is, of course, the new covenant. Verse 7, "And I will establish my covenant between me and thee and thy seed after thee in their generations for an everlasting covenant, to be a God unto thee. And I will give unto thee and to thy seed after thee the land wherein thou art a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God." That's the Abrahamic covenant. That's where it started. He doesn't need to say they shall be my people, because the people haven't begun yet. Abraham is going to be the progenitor of the people. But what he does promise is that he will be their God. That those who are part of the Abrahamic covenant will have special covenant fellowship with him. Let's go back to Ezekiel 37. And so that's what Ezekiel 37 is promising now, when it says in Ezekiel 37 and verse 23 that the nation having been united and purged, it then says at the end of that verse, "So shall they be my people and I will be their God." What Ezekiel is saying is that they are now all back in covenant relationship with God. Verse 24. It says, verse 24, "And David my servant shall be king over them, and they shall all have one shepherd. They shall also walk in my judgments and observe my statutes and do them." Now this is quite interesting. You've got to stop and think about this. Who actually is upon the throne? So the king of verse 24 is actually Christ. Now he's not David. He's the son of David. Ezekiel 37, verse 24. "David my servant shall be king over them." It's not David, it's Christ. And Christ is the son of David. Why is he described as David when he's actually David's son? Oh, hang on a minute. Yes? David was the beloved of God, yes. And in Matthew chapter 3, the Lord ascends out of the waters of baptism, and a voice says, "This is my son, the beloved." So he's the David, yes. I agree with that, but I think there's more to it than that. And it's not just this place either. Look, Jeremiah chapter 30. "I will bring again the captivity of my people Israel and Judah. They shall serve Yahweh their God and David their king, whom I will raise up unto them." Ezekiel 34, verses 23 to 24, "I will set up one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them, even my servant David. And I, Yahweh, will be their God, and my servant David a prince." Ezekiel 37, which is the one we're looking at here. "So shall they be my people, and I will be their God, and David my servant shall be king over them, and they shall all have one shepherd." And Hosea chapter 3 verse 5, "Afterward shall the children of Israel return and seek Yahweh their God and David their king." Actually, there was another note for choir members. "Afterward shall the children of Israel return and seek Yahweh their God." Israel at last shall seek the Lord, are the words of hymn 250, "and David their king." Now why is Jesus consistently described as David and not the son of David? No. Because that would still make him the son of David. I think the answer lies in this context, in the context of Ezekiel 37, I think the answer lies in the 2nd of Samuel chapter 5. Now come and have a look at this. Now this, I tell you what, this just rings true when you think about it. This has got the ring of truth about it. Again, we're arguing contextually, and I'm sure that this is, well, there might be some other reasons, but I'm sure this is one of the best ones. 2 Samuel 5, verses 1 to 5. Now here's the story of David becoming king. Then came all the tribes of Israel to David, unto Hebron, and spake, saying, Behold, we are thy bone and thy flesh. Verse 3, So all the elders of Israel came to the king to Hebron, and King David made a league with them in Hebron before Yahweh, and they anointed David king over Israel. Does anyone know what Hebron means? Hebron means fellowship. So all 12 tribes came to David and bound themselves together under his kingship in a place called fellowship. And it was David, you see, who successfully united the 12 tribes together. Verse 4, David was 30 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 40 years. Look at this. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months. He shall save the tents of Judah first. And in Jerusalem, he reigned over Israel and Judah. So, Christ is styled the David of the age to come, because as David of old, he will succeed in uniting the 12 tribes together in perfect fellowship, all under his kingship. Now, look, there might be some other reasons, but to me that's a very satisfying one contextually in terms of the argument of Ezekiel 37, which is all about making them one nation in the land. Why would you call Jesus David? Because he's going to do just what David of old did. He's going to bring together now all the 12 tribes that they might be reunited under his kingship, just as David of old. That to me is a very satisfying explanation of why he's called David their king in Ezekiel 37, and for that matter in all those other references. Alright, let's get back to Ezekiel 37 then, and just see if we can finish off these chapters, these verses rather, because I've certainly run myself out of time. Verse 25, And they shall dwell in the land that I've given unto Jacob my servant, wherein your fathers have dwelt, and they shall dwell therein, even they and their children and their children's children forever, and my servant David shall be their prince forever. You know, we need to read the Bible carefully, don't we? You see what it says there? Verse 25, at the start of the verse, they shall dwell in the land, and the end of the verse says, forever. So the promise of this chapter is that Israel dwell in the land forever. But they're actually mortal. So how do they dwell in the land forever? And Brother Thomas says, because the promise to Israel about an everlasting possession of the land is a national promise. And the nation of Israel does live forever for the 1,000 years of the kingdom of Christ. The nation of Israel is there forever, but each individual member, being mortal, dies, but the nation everlastingly lives in the land throughout the whole duration of the kingdom of Christ. It was a national promise of everlasting inheritance, and it will be fulfilled, and Israel will dwell in the land forever throughout their mortal generations. Verse 26, Moreover, I will make a covenant of peace with them. It shall be an everlasting covenant, and I'll place them and multiply them and set my sanctuary in the midst of them. Now, what's this covenant of peace in verse 26? Because, you see, we're told in Zechariah 13 that the house of Judah have already come under the terms of the new covenant. And we're told in Ezekiel 20 that the house of Israel have already been brought into the bonds of the covenant. So both houses have already been brought into the new covenant. What's the covenant of peace that's then made with them in verse 26? Well, Brother Thomas suggests this, and I believe that this is a good idea. This actually comes from Faith in the Last Days. He says, the new covenant which we now accept as a matter of faith and hope has not yet been made with the house of Judah and Israel. If it had, they would be a united nation in Palestine. It will be made with them when they are grafted in their own olive and not before. At the engrafting, now look at this, at the engrafting there will be a great national celebration called a delivering of the covenant, Ezekiel 20, a delivering of the new covenant from Zion, Micah 4, with a glorious but not such a terrible display of power as when the covenant was delivered from Sinai. The nation or 12 tribes, having been brought at length to acknowledge Jesus as high priest and king, are received unto favour, and being under the new covenant as in former years they were under the old, Yahweh becomes merciful to their unrighteousness and proclaims everlasting oblivion of all their past individual and national offences by virtue of the royal blood of the covenant, the preciousness of which they then perceive and appreciate. So what Brother Thomas suggests is that when both houses are back in the land and they've both been united and they're all dwelling under David their king, there will be a great national celebration of the new covenant all over again, a special one, to celebrate the fact that they are now truly one nation in the land and will be delivered from Zion. And so although both houses have already been brought into the new covenant, they'll be brought into another covenant, a special covenant of peace, it says. Well, what's the word for peace? It's the word shalom. And shalom, of course, means not just peace. It has to do with that which will provide harmony or unity, a covenant of harmony and unity. What an appropriate thing to make now with the whole house of Israel and Judah united back together in the land. I'll make a covenant of harmony with them. Well, most of you will know that the idea of covenant is related to the number of seven. Just look at this, verse 26. I'll make a covenant of peace with them. Who's the them? That's the 12 nations united in the land. So, I'll make a covenant of peace with them. That's one. It shall be an everlasting covenant with them. That's two. And I will place them, three, and multiply them, four, and set my sanctuary in the midst of them, five. My tabernacle also shall be with them, 6, verse 28, and my sanctuary shall be in the midst of them forevermore, 7. I will make a covenant with them, is the promise of this chapter. Verse 27, my tabernacle also shall be with them, yea, I will be their God, and they shall be my people. You know, the promise of the tabernacle with them is actually the promise of the presence of God. And who represents the presence of God amongst the nation? Who represents the presence of God? That's actually the saints, isn't it? I mean, the literal temple will be there, but so also will the saints. The saints are representative of the presence of God amongst his people. My tabernacle also shall be with them. Now just stop and think about this. I tell you, this is really good. Look, this is something worth thinking about. I'll make a covenant of peace with them. You know what this chapter really shows us? They are at peace with God. Verse 23, I will be their God. They are at peace with Messiah. Verse 24, David shall be king. They are at peace with the saints. My tabernacle shall be with them. Verse 27. They are at peace with the nations, verse 28, and the heathen shall know that I, Yahweh, do sanctify Israel. And finally, they are at peace with each other, verse 22, neither shall they be divided into two kingdoms any more, and I will make a covenant of peace with them. Oh, isn't that what this chapter is all about? At peace with God, at peace with Messiah, at peace with the saints, at peace with the nations, and at peace with themselves. I'll make them one nation in the land. Brother Thomas summarizes that in Exposition of Daniel, page 103. He says the order of events is, first, the avenging of the Holy Land in the overthrow of the Gentile armies upon the mountains of Israel. Secondly, the saving of the tents of Judah. Thirdly, the deliverance of Jerusalem. Fourthly, the bringing of the whole house of Israel, not in the land, at the saving of Judah's tents, into the wilderness of the people, to bear their shame there for 40 years. And fifthly, the bringing of them thence, after they have borne their shame, into the land of Israel, and making them one nation with Judah, under the new covenant, by which Yahweh's servant David II becomes their high priest and king for a season and a time. The whole house of Israel will thus be united under one head into one nation and kingdom for the first time since the revolt of the 10 tribes from the house of David in the 3rd year of Solomon's successor. Now when this work is perfected, Yahweh says, that not one of them shall be left in their enemies' lands, such a thorough gleaning will be made of them from among the nations. Well, brothers and sisters, they're all home now, according to Ezekiel 37. And they're back in the land together under David their king. It's a wonderful story. You know, how could you not believe in the Israelitist nature of the truth? How could you not believe that that to which we've been espoused is related to the house and to the people of Israel? How could those prophecy, if you dispense with Israel as being a part in God's purpose, when will all of those prophecies be fulfilled? And where did we get it all from? Brother Thomas, Mystery of the Covenant. There's no shame, you know, in reading good books. And that's a very good book. And as I hope you will have seen from these studies, we haven't simply followed what Brother Thomas has said. What Brother Thomas does is leads us back into the Word for ourselves to look at the Word. But he helps us to at least get some of the references. He brings them together marvellously that we might marvel at the way in which Scripture is locked together in place after place. But we look at the Bible for ourselves, and we are happy indeed that these things are so. Well, we believe that that's all going to happen very shortly, and that it will be the privilege of some of us to work with the house of Judah and with the house of Israel and with our Lord in the day when that great work of restoration shall take place. And we look forward to the final fulfillment of all those things when God indeed will make them one nation in the land.